Hello, welcome to Unofficial Partner, the Sports Business Podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. In 2017, Laurie Youngson led a group of women to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro to play a record-breaking football match with the campaigning group Equal Playing Field to highlight gender inequalities in sport. During this experience, Laurie discovered that the women were all wearing boots made for men or children, which left their feet in pain long after the final whistle blew. That's the origin story of IDA Sports, the company Laura co-founded with Ben Sandu, former professional cricketer from Melbourne. Today you'll find IDA on the shelves of some of the big sports retailers, but it's not been an easy journey, and this is a conversation about what Laurie Youngson's learned along the way about how the sports business works, how the market power exerted by famous shoe brands shapes our buying habits, the counterintuitive relationship between young girls and their sporting idols, and finally how she thinks the women's professional game should evolve. So take me through the sort of realpolitik of trying to get your boots on Sam Kerr's feet.
Oh, well, probably wouldn't get it on Sam Kerr's feet. She's a little expensive, but we are playing our own version of Moneyball at the moment, which is working out who's the best player that aligns with the brand that fits with the profile. But I guess the fun and sad thing is that it's very achievable in women's sport at the moment. There are some players that have reasonably high valuations, nothing like compared to the men's game. But there's a lot of the players in the WSL 1, 2, the NWSL who don't have any contracts at all. And the buy-in is, here's a free pair of boots, like it or lump it sort of thing. And I think part of my goal is to change that approach, and even like being in an auction house and just ratcheting up the pressure a little. That's a lovely mission of ours as well, is can you get better contracts for all of the players whilst providing them with super awesome shoes that do great things.
This episode is sponsored by We Are Sweet, the leading provider of digital platforms for the sports industry. Are you responsible for digital, but not sure what to do with all the data you've collected? We Are Sweet excels in best-in-class software, ranging from unique engagement experiences to next-generation websites with more than a decade of innovation, alongside names like IMG, ATP, Professional Triathletes Organization, and Formula One. You can trust that their software delivers. Whether you're looking to kickstart your community and transform the way you communicate with professional players, bring data to life in a second screen experience, or you need a website that monetizes fans, We Are Sweet is the partner you need. Visit wearesweet.co.uk to turn your digital aspirations into tangible success stories. I've got a load of questions. I think what you're doing is really interesting in and of itself, but also I think it's really interesting in terms of what it says about the marketplace and what you've learned along the way about how this market works. Because we all talk about Nike, Adidas, Puma, blah, blah, blah. And quite often when I talk to someone who knows anything about it, the stuff that I focus on is completely irrelevant. It's actually about supply chains and the retail relationships and all of that. So at some point I'd like to just get into the weeds of it. But I suppose the first question is, I was going to frame this as the business of women's feet, which I thought was quite, you know, that's a title we'll go with. There's a bit of me that looks at what you're doing and says, right, you're marketing, there's a company here, there's a product you're marketing, but you're also marketing the category. You're also creating a category, which is always harder work. Just take me inside what you've learned about this market.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a good place to start, really, is you say it's harder, but actually creating a category in some ways is, in business theory, you talk about red ocean and blue ocean. It's very exciting because it's an entirely new space. And when you go into the retailers, you're not actually displacing people from shelves, which is one of the hardest things to do as a new brand. We've been able to create new spaces because they're effectively retooling their stores to cater to women. So whereas before you'd probably have to like fight elbow space with some of the bigger brands, now we go on they call gondolas or pedestal, because they're pulling together all these women's shoes that just didn't exist before. So it's been really exciting actually to see the gap and see the opportunity and see that come to life in retail.
What's red ocean, blue ocean? You better explain what that is, because I've never heard of that.
So effectively, if you're entering a market, you can either enter a red ocean where you have like all the sharks circling and you'll probably get like lose a leg pretty quickly. Right. Or blue ocean, and it's kind of clear and no one's hanging out there, and maybe you'll have beautiful snorkeling and go and see some great fish. So it's kind of this theory of, do you want to play in a crowded market? And potentially you do, and maybe you've got the money behind you to do that. Or do you want to try something completely different that no one else has done? And I think in our case, this goes like when people say, oh, why aren't you making men's shoes or men's football boots? You're like, well, there's quite a few, to be honest. Whereas there's really not very many women's shoes. So we'll play over here in this space.
A lot of your communications is about the problem that you're solving, isn't it? I think I've noticed. It's like almost there's a sort of insurance brand, the way you present it. There's a bit of it, which is when someone gets injured, the conversation quite often goes to boots and equipment. And then you get to the bigger issue of the sort of divide, and then you've got the sort of gender split, and people get cross about that. So there's that whole theme that runs through it. So how do you approach that? Take me into the comms strategy.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, to your point, an education piece where often, and it's both with women and men, that you talk to women and you're like, hey, did you know your feet are different to men's feet? And you've been wearing shoes that are for little boys your entire life. And they're like, what? And less so than perhaps that hard fact, but more like, this is how what you might have experienced. You get pain in your little toe because it's not in the right place, or you might lose your toenails because, again, the toe box isn't shaped for you, or you might get really bad blisters at your heels. And then people start to go, oh, wait, no, that I've had that happen to me. Ah, okay. And you start to see the penny drop. So there's definitely kind of you need to pass through the education. For some people, you need to pass through the education barrier, like, okay, I fundamentally, when women's and men's feet are different. Others, it's they find us and they're like, oh, thank goodness you're here. Such a relief. I found you, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it is really fascinating once you kind of dive into it. But you point out really simple things like, hey, have you seen how many women's running shoes there are? And people are like, oh, wait, yeah, I totally buy a women's running shoe. Why wouldn't I buy a women's football shoe?
And what is the problem? What from the, on the other side, why are they not responding to this market? Is it just complacency? Are there real practical problems that you're asking of the big, what do we call them? Big boot?
Big brands, yeah. I think it's a mixture of things. Traditionally, it just hasn't been the big money earner. Men's football is where the money's at. But for a startup brand, it's great that we're in a growing market in a space that continues to accelerate. So I find it fascinating to be in this place. I think for the bigger brands, you obviously have to open up a new line of tooling. You have to make new lasts. You have to do all this kind of thing, market in a different way, do the research. But I mean, they got quite a lot of money, so you'd think it would be okay. But I think traditionally it's just been like, hey, oh yeah, we've got all these other things to focus on, like American football, soccer, NBA. Oh wait, women's football. Yeah, we can do something in that. And I think the difference is perhaps that for us, it's never an afterthought. It's just the thing that we do. And so you can spend all of your research money and all of your focus just answering these questions and really making, like focusing on the innovation and making the stuff that people want.
And what's the prize? What, in terms of, do you quantify the prize? Because obviously I've seen you've got some high profile investment companies that have come along for the ride. So you've sold them the dream. What's the market potential here?
I think, well, I mean, there's so many opportunities. And for us, it's the women's football boot market is growing massively. In the US, it's pretty mature. I think obviously the stat around like women's football in the UK is expected to be a $1 billion pounds market. I think we see the numbers growing in the game and look to take a decent market share of that. And if you take a decent market share, then you have a very sizable business that gets to do really fun things. I think I look very much at like the other disruptors in the market. So like Castor popped out of nowhere and now been quite disruptive around obviously the sponsorships. and what's happening there. And that you would never have thought that a completely new brand could have entered football in the UK and shaken it up in that way.
So it's interesting. So in terms of the, let's go to the sort of top end then, in terms of the visibility, and you've got the WSL, what happens? Because Nike are an official partner. Tell me about that official category, how you get your product, make it famous on television.
Yes.
Castore is an interesting, you know, it's an interesting case study because they bought licenses in different clubs and done it that way. And people, there's a visibility that goes with the league. Boots is obviously individual.
In general, yes, individual.
So take me through the sort of realpolitik of trying to get your boots on Sam Kerr's feet.
Oh, well, probably wouldn't get it on Sam Kerr's feet. She's a little expensive, but we are playing our own version of Moneyball at the moment, which is working out kind of who's the best player that aligns with the brand that fits with the profile. But I guess the fun and sad thing is that it's very achievable in women's sport at the moment. There are some players that have kind of very high value, reasonably high valuations, nothing like compared to the men's game. But there's a lot of the players in the WSL 1, 2, the NWSL who don't have any contracts at all. And it sort of, the buy-in is, here's a free pair of boots, like it or lump it sort of thing. And I think part of my goal is to change that approach, and even, you know, like being in an auction house and just ratcheting up the pressure a little. That's a lovely mission of ours as well, is to, can you get better contracts for all of the players whilst providing them with super awesome shoes that do great things?
So you're sort of doing two things at once there. One, you're getting shoes on their feet so they appear on television. So there's a sort of brand building exercise. That last bit, if I'm your accountant, I'm worried because you're now pushing the price up of your license,
It's going to go up anyway, right? Like if you follow the trends, it should. I guess we're entering the market. Yeah. And like my accountant doesn't love me, to be honest, because I'm always thinking of all these things and they're like, don't do that.
It's healthy to relate with an accountant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
A bad sign if your accountant likes you.
Yeah, exactly. That you want like a take no prisoners CFO. That's the best part. But I think for me, it's the, can you change an entire ecosystem? And we have a really great opportunity here to just mix it up and disrupt it completely, but also get great products on the feet of players and make them visible and then get more kind of trickle down the pyramid players being able to wear them and be part of that movement.
How many players do you think sell boots in a marketing sense today? I mean, I'm assuming that grows, but trying to put an ROI on that.
Do you want to hear a curious thing? So if you're a guy and Ronaldo releases a boot there, or Messi releases a boot, then you buy the boot because Ronaldo, you want to play like Ronaldo or Messi. And this holds true for whatever age, right? Women don't think like that. So actually, the more important thing is to connect with women across the clubs and across the locales. So if you've got a local player who's perhaps not the most famous player but really connects well with the club, they're the ones that really make the difference in terms of selling shoes. And we just try a different approach. So whilst it is great to have your superstar players, I think the women's game is so different and how we buy and purchase is so different that actually we approach the sponsorship and things like that quite differently. So perhaps how the bigger brands have a strategy.
So just walk me through that then. So girls aren't influenced by superstar players?
Not in the same way. So you can be terribly inspired and you want to play like them. But when it comes down to purchasing decisions, women have a very different psychology. And so it really helps for brand awareness and kind of that kind of side of things. But really the factors that influence parents are very much what you'd expect. So price sensitive, value for money, and for teenage girls, definitely the colorways.
I was going to say, because you've got this, the other bit to it is that you have to excite people as well, don't you? Because you can do all of that work about, it's about saving you pain and injury. You know, there's a sort of fear button that you can press. But at the end of the day, you have to
love these things to put them on your feet and you want to fall in love with the brand. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. If you've got a 13-year-old, they won't wear it unless it looks great. So yeah, we've done a lot of work over the last 18 months and really improving the aesthetic to make sure that it kind of matches the science and the tech that we've got in the shoes.
And how does that manifest? What's the difference between the way you're approaching it and the others?
Well, we try not to start with a pink palette, which is traditionally what has been kind of the industry term is shrink it and pink it. Yeah. So take a man's shoe and just shrink it, stick some pink on, they'll love it. And so actually we do some crazy things, like we talk to women and we ask them what they want and then we put those in a shoe.
Who knew?
So it's been wild, that kind of innovation. So this is why the current ones are white and teal. We asked players what they'd love and they were like, yeah, we'll have that. And they've sold out. So, you know.
In terms of that, I mean, it is weird. And I keep coming back to why, I guess it's an incentive thing that they don't move because, as you say, their eyes are elsewhere. It's the same conversation. It's a similar conversation than that you have with people who are running women's football clubs in the focus question you keep coming back to. And I quote Cara from Angel City quite a lot, where she came on the podcast and was saying, like, you know, they get up at 7-8 in the morning and think about the women's team, whereas the clubs, UEFA, FIFA, don't. You know, they're sort of, it's an afternoon conversation once they've sorted out the men's game. And it might be as obvious and simple as that. It feels like this is a microcosm of that conversation.
100%. Like, I wake up in the morning and I'm, in a non-creepy, weird way, thinking about women's feet. Like, that is just what I do all day, every day.
See, if I said that, it would be creepy, but it's okay for you to say that.
It would be. We get sent lots of photos of feet, which is always, it's weird. It is weird, I have to say, but very helpful for designing new shoes. So we spend all of our time thinking about the research, thinking about the colors, thinking about the consumer and how we can make things better. And it is literally our focus. And I think that's why we've been able to accelerate and make so much progress in such a short space of time with perhaps completely limited resources compared to the bigger brands, because we're just completely focused on building the best football boot for women.
And how do you make them? Because obviously when you get to that question of, okay, if and it sounds like everything is snowballing. So production is one of those boring areas which people don't focus on, but actually is fundamentally important. And when, you know, you get to economies of scale type arguments, you get to price per year, all of those things. But how do you actually, I can see making the first few boots and you have to really expensive, but just take me through that process. How do you actually manufacture these things?
Yeah, it's a bit like playing a video game. So each time you step up with the amount of pairs you make, you get a better factory. And so you can do more and have more capability. So you beat the boss and then you're like, whoa, I made it to the next level. And so we've just been on that journey and kind of stepped up, built, you know, new relationships, new factories, and been able to improve the quality and the output and the cost at each level. So you are playing this kind of game of, okay, what value can we create within the shoe and what materials do we have access to? And then at the same time, can you start to reduce your COGS, which is the cost of the shoe per shoe as you increase? So you do get these economies of scale as you grow and get bigger. So you become a more profitable business. And at some point you do reach a scale and distribution kind of challenge, and you either need to get absorbed into something else in order to kind of finance it, because the amount of shoes we make starts to become, you know, it's a lot of money to be putting there. But you, at the same time, we finance all of our production through our retail contracts. So we're very lucky we get the purchase order in advance so that we know that we've got the money there. And then we go make the shoes, and then you sell the shoes and you get into this lovely cycle.
And okay, that's interesting. So you get the retailer's check, or you get the promise of the retailer's check. So you get
a promise. Yes.
Where does the power lie in that bit of the supply chain? Where, in terms of the retailers, who sells big amounts of women's boots?
Well, if you are a big brand, you have a lot of negotiating power. If you're a small brand, then you are beholden to the terms that they gift to you. And it's really, again, it's a bit like a game. You have to make sure you do everything in your power to reduce the sort of penalties that you get around it, reduce the terms, like try and get yourself on net 30 again. My accountant does indeed love me. And then again, you try and sell through as fast as you can, which demonstrates the ability to then buy more and increase your footprint. So we've been able to grow really nicely in the US, especially because we've got into the three biggest retailers there.
Yeah. We've started Foot Locker.
Not yet.
Who are the big retailers in the States?
So Dick's Sporting Goods is probably the biggest one that most people have heard of. Yeah. They're awesome. And they've done a big transformation over the last few years to really focus on soccer. So they've built these House of Soccer stores, which are amazing. So we're in those. And again, those are the retailers that we've been able to have cool chats with about the retail experience for women and girls and kind of change how you're ranged in store. So you can be a 9-year-old and you can walk into a store and actually see yourself represented.
Yeah. And what about the UK? Where are the sort of bottlenecks in the retail?
It's moving slowly at glacial pace. You may have seen some of the retailers got wrapped on the knuckles by the MPs recently, who've produced a report into women's football. We are slowly, slowly kicking that door down. I'm so ready to go into retail in the UK. You need that right person to open the door, and then you will walk through it. We'll probably dance through it by that point.
Okay. And if I am your competitor or I like big boot as a phrase. I'm going to start to use that. But what can I do to squeeze you out? What in terms of at that retail sort of point? Because I'm looking at this from the classic marketing, mental availability and physical availability. That physical availability is really key. It's the bit that, you know, they have to be in the shop when you've done all the work, you've got people excited, you've got them, you've done all the above the line marketing. And then you get to, I don't know, Mike Ashew's place or where whoever the retailer is, and they're not there. So what is it that the real world obstacles that you're facing getting into those stores?
Just the buyers. It's not the bigger brands necessarily who are focused on their own strategy. It's literally having the person internally who says, yes, we want to change things and we want to bring women's boots into the mix. And I don't know how many pictures from dads of 9-year-old daughters who walk in and see boys and on, you know, boys' shoes, and my daughter can't find anything. I don't know how many of those it's going to take, but I think the consumers are ready for it. We have a product that's ready for it, that's selling through really well in the US. So for me, it's a no-brainer, which is why we keep pursuing it.
And is that just sexism and misogyny and complacency and men who biases and don't see it?
I think it's just been traditionally, if you think about the NWSL versus the WSL, the UK has just been a bit slower to kind of get the hang of, oh, women play football. Oh. And then the Euros has somewhat accelerated that, but it's still on this journey. Whereas in the US, it's been very commonplace for women to be on the football pitch. So I'm really confident there will be change. It's just whether I get loads of grey hairs before it does change.
So there's no sort of buying out space at a retailer. So I'm, again, if I'm looking to crowd you out, I'm going to buy up.
Oh, totally.
Up shelves and
yeah, you can do things like that. But the thing is, you won't have the authentic nature of a beautiful little startup brand that connects with the store manager who makes sure that when there's a little bit of space, they'll squeeze us in and put us on a pedestal that's a little empty for 2 weeks, or tells their customer about us instead of the other shoes. So where we win is the hearts and minds of the actual store assistants who have been amazing, or when people are Googling or their SEO, we can't outbid on certain terms, but we can on others, and people find us online. Word of mouth has been amazing. So there's definitely, whilst you don't have the marketing budget of the bigger brands, we're definitely quite creative and our story resonates with a lot of the people who are doing the selling.
So my mind jumps to going around the retailers and what the implications of that would be. And I saw on your website, you've got a D2C operation. What are the implications of that? Because again, you can see that, why don't you do that? But it's always, this is across sport more generally, people are saying, right, we need to do a D2C thing. We need to have that channel direct to the customers. What, from your point of view, from where you are now, what are the implications of doing that at scale?
I just think you need both spaces or multiple spaces. But I think retail's amazing because, I mean, what's your first thought when you're like, oh, I've got to go get my kids some shoes for the season? Mm. It's like either you have a browse on the internet or you'll go take them and have a bit of a look-see and see what's there. So I think there's definitely a place for kind of go try on stuff. But then there's also, we see so many people buying online, and that culture really changed during COVID. So it's not been a barrier to us getting shoes to people. And we pop up at a lot of tournaments and go visit a lot of clubs. And that's a really good way to kind of start selling into these places. And once you're in one, you get a ripple effect amongst people. Again, this word of mouth. So it's been, I think, some of the most interesting channels are things like affiliate channels. So someone else runs a store and they get a kickback but they don't necessarily host our products. We do all the fulfillment. And that's been a really good way for us to kind of grow our footprint and our marketing footprint without necessarily making our logistics more complex.
So the margin on that is going to be better than getting it through a retail and...
Yeah, exactly. So the margins on those are better. So it's kind of, I think it's a win-win because there was much less risk on the part of the affiliate. And then we still have a lot of stock and optionality then for moving stock around.
It's quite an interesting market. I mean, again, look at me, this is not my marketplace, but that sort of influencer creator world where it meets the trainer apparel marketplace is a really interesting spot. And I remember talking to people from Adidas and from Nike and from Puma about their use of creators, how that has shifted, linking it to selling product as well, which,
yeah,
you know, as that direct link. Take me into that world, because it feels like that's a spot that, like, there's the drops and there's a sort of secret code that I'm not privy to about, you know, stuff that comes through on Instagram, which is just there's a whole mass there which I find fascinating. But how does it work? What, from your point of view, it must be a big opportunity.
It is a big opportunity, but I think that there's some stuff that's super glittery but can be a distraction.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at, I mean, one of the things we do, so yeah, we work with certain influencers and creators and get the message out there, but some of our biggest channels are actually Facebook, because moms and dads are shopping for their kids and they're still on Facebook and they're doing that, and that's their community. So you can waste a load of money like running new ads and this and that and the other in different channels. But actually, I go back to knowing your customer and really knowing where they are and what they want. And that's like, our goal is to be as lean and efficient as possible. And so that means we do test stuff. We test stuff all the time, but we focus in on the stuff that really converts and is really hitting with the consumer.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like when people talk about Martin, you know, TikTok versus LinkedIn. LinkedIn is where everything, you know, a business conversation, everyone is driving towards that, but it's really boring. It's really, it's such a boring platform. And, you know, I feel boring just as soon as I get on it, as soon as I start typing something on LinkedIn, I feel like my, you know, oh God, the color just drains away. You know what I mean? So it's really annoying that if
very serious.
I know it is very serious. It's very earnest. And anyway, let's not get onto LinkedIn.
What I learned.
Exactly.
I love things.
Jake Humphrey is a perfect sort of, you know, LinkedIn person. He gets up at 5, he does, you know, goes to the, you know, whatever. But we've talked about the sort of nuts and bolts of it, the retail end of it. A lot of people in this audience are looking at things like FIFA's relationship. I wonder what do you see around major events? So we're getting to the Lionesses level, or we're getting to the American national side, and at major events, Euros, World Cups. What does that look like from where you are? My assumption being, okay, there's a spike in interest and it drives a lot of campaign. But is that true, do you think?
Massively. So, I mean, well, from our side, We see the retail spikes every time there's a big tournament, and it is terribly frustrating that the Lionesses are not in the Olympics this year from a sales point of view, amongst other things. But you see that reflected in the sales numbers because people are really focused and kind of looking at the sport. I think you saw after the Euros how many new players there were and female clubs and things like that. And that's not really an aberration. It happens because people get interested in it, and it becomes easier to play. So in terms of our interest, we see it, and it's really awesome. I think the World Cup more so than the Olympics, because that's kind of a bit of a different competition. But you also see it around things like Champions League. And what I find fascinating is that there's this kind of global fan. So Americans are really watching Champions League. They're watching WSL as well. Almost the fans of the women's game. You know, you can have multiple teams and you follow multiple players, and you're just more interested in all the things that are happening, the growth of the game, rather than necessarily I'm a diehard tribal particular fan of a team.
I sometimes think that a two-year, you know, a biennial or whatever it is, a Women's World Cup every 2 years at this moment in the development would actually be a good thing. I mean, you know, that when this comes around, generally, I'm all about scarcity and whatever, but I do think where women's football is in terms of its sort of place and the potential.
But would you have a biannual World Cup over a club championship, like a world club championship where you get the best Brazilian teams playing the European teams? And
well, you were at our women's football brainstorm at the Zone.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of love in the room for a sort of controlled club Super League.
No, there wasn't. But perhaps it was the way it was done, you know, the structures that were set up. But I think scarcity at this stage, otherwise you can get the fatigue set in. But also you have to remember, like, COVID years, sport went all haywire. And it's only really now that we've started to get back into the cycle. Like, we've got the Euros in 25, and then you got to wait a year, and then you have the World Cup. So I think there is this nice cycle where you get to see the best players on the world stage. But I think, and also if you increase the load, I don't think it would necessarily be the best thing for players. So the question becomes then, how do you make perhaps the rest of the pyramids more competitive so you can have more interesting games further down the pyramid that people want to go and watch?
But the quicker way would be to do it, to use FIFA's footprint. Rather, I'm with you, and I'm, you know, fully bought into building the WSL, building the individual clubs, building whatever frameworks work to grow the participation. I just think from where we are in 2024, if the World Cup is disproportionately important, I think do more of it for a period of time. So then you're getting the impetus. Again, it comes back to what we did in the Zone, is that the big problems are all obvious about calendar chaos of an individual career, the pressure we're putting on the top players to play club, build club brands is really hard work. I get it. And sometimes I think, well, actually, a World Cup does a lot of that work.
It definitely raises the consciousness. And I mean, I've seen in Australia what's happened after the World Cup there, which was amazing. And they've had so much kind of momentum off the back of it and sold out crowds for the Matildas, whereas perhaps before it would have really not been, people wouldn't have cared. But I don't know, that's a question for above my pay grade. But if I had the money, I'd still be going for that Club World Championship.
That would be, yeah. I mean, I agree that that's where we want to get to, and we want, because it means that people are more tribal, they're going to turn up, you know, and then it gets beyond that sort of bigger event audience into real fans, inverted commas. But I just wonder what that link is, because obviously you're very linked to participation, major events.
It is and it isn't. I mean, the things that we don't see in the UK is some of the biggest events in the US are like these mega tournaments that are youth team tournaments where you have, like, I don't know, 1,500 teams that go and compete over a weekend. All girls, right? Mm. And you're just like, whoa, like the scale of it, we can't even conceive of it in the UK. And yeah, they kind of follow the World Cup and yeah, they kind of follow the Olympics, but they're more focused on playing. And so there's really this, like, that's their lives. And they go and they're on these travel teams and they play every weekend and they fly across the country and they're building their soccer careers. And I just find it mind-boggling, the scale of what happens in the US, especially around participation. And in some ways, my point is the amateur scene maybe doesn't need it. And there's a difference. We've done a lot of research on the fan and the athlete, and they don't always coincide. So there's a kind of Venn diagram where you have people who are fans and are athletes. But there's also lots of people who are just fans and quite a few people who are just athletes who aren't really that bothered about the game or following the game. And I find that fascinating because it's not as strong an overlap as you think it is.
Yeah, that's interesting. And what proportion are you selling in the States then? Is the States your dominant marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment it's 80%. So it's really a big focus. And especially states like Texas, which are growing massively. They literally can't build enough soccer pitches to keep up with demand, which is, I mean, amazing to watch.
Yeah. Well, that's huge then, isn't it? I didn't realise that was the split.
Yeah, it's massive, which is why I'm still a little disappointed by the UK, to be honest.
Yeah. Like,
get me those retailer doors open, because I feel quite patriotic about it. But you have to go where the customers are. We also have a lot of interest from Europe. And so hopefully in our roadmap is a plan to open up in Europe. Kind of got a little scuppered by Brexit.
Yeah.
Damn it. But there's still a lot of demand there. And as we've seen, women's football is growing massively.
Yeah, yeah. So, Griffin, what's the 10-year prediction? You can talk to me about the business, but just that marketplace. What's your sense of the game from where you're sitting? Are we really at a key moment here, or has this been growing for 10, 15 years? Because a lot of the excitement, or you know, a lot of fevered coverage of women's football, and you know, it's fantastic to see crowds at Arsenal. It feels like a moment, but from where you are, is it more gradual than that?
I think what we've seen is it's been growing for a while and then suddenly it's perhaps popped into national consciousness. And so now your average person who perhaps wouldn't have been on their radar is now talking about it or talking about their favourite player or going to a game because it's suddenly become a lot more accessible. Like being able to go to the Emirates is obviously a lot easier. And I know there's been a lot of chat about, for example, the women's game, it's easier to get a ticket if you're a family. And it's cheaper and you can take your kids, whereas actually to try and get to the Emirates for a men's game is virtually impossible. So you've got something that is more accessible and continuing to grow. I think the 10-year thing is, can it be sustainable? So will people consistently choose this as their form of entertainment over something else? And I think talking to a lot of the American clubs, the question for them is, we're not just competing with sport, we're competing with all the other things that are going on, all the leisure activities that people have. And how do you encourage people to continue, like to follow it and then continue to follow it? Because I think, especially with the women's game, there's all these kind of societal benefits that come out of it and what the England team have been able to do off the back of the Euros and advocating for change and advocating for participation in sport. I don't think that's going to change. Like, as in, people will still continue to do that and that will be associated with the women's game. And so hopefully then you get the revenues to back it up and continue to allow some of these clubs and players to have this platform. So that I think it will hopefully end up with this very nice, sustainable few leagues. I'd love to see a few more teams in the WSL pyramids so that it widens up a bit. I'd love to see the NWSL have relegation and promotion. I just don't understand American system where you can't have jeopardy of not having a relegation. Like, what's in it? Like, what's the point? But they've got some really interesting things like the USL, the new women's league in Division One professional league, that's a kind of competing league. And that's in all these new cities that historically haven't had women's teams. So again, it's a very exciting time and you're waiting to see. It's a bit like the Wild West, waiting to see who's going to win out in what kind of format. But I think what we've seen over the last 10 years and what we'll see over the next 10 years is it's the game and people watching it is here to stay. Like, people, there is demand. People want to see it. They want to watch it. They want to take their kids to see it. And so it's then how does the rest of the ecosystem support that?
And in terms of your own sort of journey through that, is it, obviously the focus is always on football boots, but is there, what's the product line? You've got other stuff, but is it always going to be, for, as you say, there's loads of competition in, go back to your red and blue ocean point. Is it all on that one story?
Yes. And I mean, I think shoes everywhere, and our goal is to make the best women's football boot on the planet. But at the same time, we're aware that consumers ask us, it's crazy. We ask our consumers and they tell us what they want and then we make it. And a lot of them have asked us for things that are off pitch. So fashion, more fashionable lifestyle kind of items that then you can see the brand growing in that direction of being almost a complete women's football kit out. And I think there's just such an opportunity to keep growing. So for us, every year there's something new and exciting that comes along, or an interesting collaboration. So I see us continuing to push out a bit further. And I think up till now, we've maybe, you try and copy the bigger brands, but the stuff we've got coming in 25, we're really stepping into our own identity and forging ahead with our own innovation. So that's been really exciting to kind of like, all right, great, we've bought into the market. Okay, we know what we're doing. And now it's like, no, we're going to lead. And that's what I'd expect us to do for the next 10 years.
Well, good luck with it, obviously.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming on. And I look forward to seeing you in Brighton at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great.